Bond laid down the glass. He said gloomily, "That's not a castle. That's a fortress. How am I supposed to get into the bloody place?" "The superintendent asks if you're a good swimmer. I have had a complete outfit sent down from my ninjutsu establishment. The seaward wall would present no problems." "I can swim well enough. But how do I get to the base of the wall? Where do I start from?" "The superintendent says there is an Ama island called Kuro, only half a mile out to sea."
"What's an Ama island?"
"They exist in different places round Japan. I believe there are some 50 such settlements. The Ama are a tribe whose girls dive for the awabi shells, that is our local abalone, a clam. It is a great delicacy. They sometimes dive for pearl oysters. They dive naked. Some of them are very beautiful, but they keep themselves very much to themselves, and visitors to their islands are completely discouraged. They have their own primitive culture and customs. I suppose you could compare them to sea gypsies. They rarely marry outside the tribe, and it is that which has made them a race apart."
"Sounds intriguing. But how am I going to make a base on this Kuro Island? I may have to wait days for the weather to be right."
Tiger spoke rapidly to the superintendent, and there was a lengthy reply. "Oh, so this guy," said Tiger with interest and enthusiasm. He turned to Bond. "It seems that the superintendent is distantly related to a family on Kuro. It is a most interesting family. There is a father and a mother and one daughter. She is called Kissy Suzuki. I have heard of her. When she was 17, she became famous in Japan by being chosen to go to Hollywood to make a film. They wanted a Japanese diving girl of great beauty, and someone had heard of her. She made the film, but hated Hollywood and longed only to return to her Ama life. She could have made a fortune, but she retired to this obscure island. There was a great to-do in the press at the time, and it was judged that she had behaved most honorably. They christened her the Japanese Garbo. But Kissy will now be 23, and everyone has forgotten about her. The superintendent says that he could arrange for you to stay with his family. They seem to have some obligation towards him. He says it is a simple house, but comfortable because of the money this girl earned in Hollywood. The other houses on the island are nothing but fishermen's shacks."
"But won't the rest of the community resent me being there?"
"No. The people of this island belong to the Shinto religion. The superintendent will speak to the Shinto priest, and everything will be okay."
"All right. So I stay on this island, and then one night I swim across to the wall. How do I get up it?"
"You will have the ninja outfit. It is here. You have seen how it is used. You will use it. It is very simple.
As I saw from the man who fell into the moat. Then what do I do?"
"You hide in the grounds and wait for an opportunity to kill him. How you do that is up to you. As I told you, he goes about in armor. A man in armor is very vulnerable. You only have to knock him off his feet. Then you will throttle him with the ninja chain you will be wearing round your waist. If his wife is with him, he will throttle her, too. She is certainly involved in all this business, and anyway, she is too ugly to live. Then you escape over the wall and swim back to Kuro. There you will be picked up by the police launch, which will visit the place at once. The news of the death will quickly get round." Bond said doubtfully,
"Well, it all sounds very simple. But what about these guards? The place is crawling with them."
"You must just keep out of their way. As you can see, the park is full of hiding places."
"Thanks very much. One of those poison bushes or up one of those trees. I don't want to blind myself or go mad."
"The ninja clothing will give you complete protection. You will have a black suit for night and a camouflage one for the day. You will wear the swimming goggles to protect your eyes. All this equipment you will tow over in a plastic bag which will be provided."
"My dear Tiger, you've thought of everything. But I'd much rather have just one little gun."
"That would be crazy, Bondo-san. You know perfectly well that silence will be essential, and with a silencer, which would be very heavy to swim with, the speed of the bullet would be so much reduced that you might not pierce the armor. No, my friend, use ninjutsu. It is the only way."
"All right," said Bond resignedly. "Now, let's have a look at a photograph of this chap. Has the superintendent got one?"
It had been taken from a long way away with a telephoto lens. It showed a giant figure in full medieval chain armor with the jagged, winged helmet of ancient Japanese warriors. Bond studied the photograph carefully, noting the vulnerable spots at neck and joints.
A metal shield protected the man's groin. A wide-bladed samurai sword hung from his waist, but there was no sign of any other weapon. Bond said thoughtfully, "Doesn't look as daft as he ought to. Probably because of the Dracula setting. Have you got one of his face? Perhaps he looks a bit madder in the raw." The superintendent went to the bottom of his file and extracted what looked like a blown-up copy of Dr. Guntram Shatterhand's passport photograph and handed it over. Bond took it nonchalantly. Then his whole body stiffened. He said to himself, "God Almighty. God Almighty." Yes, there was no doubt. No doubt at all. He had grown a drooping black moustache. He had had the syphilitic nose repaired. There was a gold-capped tooth among the upper frontals. But there could be no doubt. Bond looked up. He said, "Have you got one of the woman?" Startled by the look of controlled venom on Bond's face, and by the pallor that showed through the walnut dye, the superintendent bowed energetically and scrabbled through his file. Yes. There she was, the bitch. The flat, ugly, wardress face, the dull eyes, the scraped back bun of hair. Bond held the pictures, not looking at them, thinking. Ernst, Stavro, Blofeld, Irma Bunt. So, this was where they had come to hide. And the long, strong gut of fate had lassoed him to them. They, of all people, he, of all people. A taxi ride down the coast in this remote corner of Japan. Could they smell him coming? Had the dead spy got hold of his name and told them? Unlikely. The power and prestige of Tiger would have protected him. Privacy, discretion are the heartbeat of Japanese inns. But would they know that an enemy was on his way, that fate had arranged this appointment in Samara? Bond looked up from the pictures. He was in cold control of himself. This was now a private matter. It had nothing to do with Tiger or Japan. It had nothing to do with Magic 44. It was ancient feud. He said casually, "Tiger, could the superintendent inquire what his detectives have made of that Black Dragon agent and of his belongings? I'm particularly interested to know whether he may have telephoned or telegraphed my description or my purpose in coming down here." There was a long and electric silence in the room. Tiger examined Bond's face with piercing interest before he passed the inquiry on to the superintendent. The superintendent picked up the receiver of an old-fashioned telephone on a double hook. He spoke into it, then, a Japanese habit, blew sharply into the mouthpiece to clear the line and spoke again at length. He said, "Ah, sodesuka," many times. Then he put down the receiver. When he had finished talking, Tiger turned to Bond. Again, with the same piercing appraisal of Bond's face, he said, "The man came from these parts. He has a police record. Fortunately, he was poorly educated and is known as nothing more than a stupid thug. On the first page of the diary, he wrote down his assignment, which was only to follow me to my destination and then report to his master. It seems unlikely that he was provided with funds for expensive communications. But what is it, Bond-san? Is it that you know these people?" James Bond laughed. It was a laugh that grated. Even to Bond it sounded harsh and false in the small room. He had immediately made up his mind to keep his knowledge to himself. To reveal the true identity of Dr. Shatterhand would be to put the whole case back into official channels. The Japanese Secret Service and the CIA would swarm down to Fukuoka. Blofeld and Irma Bunt would be arrested. James Bond's personal prey would be snatched from him. There would be no revenge. Bond said, "Good Lord, no, but I am something of a physiognomist. When I saw this man's face, it was as if someone had walked over my grave. I have a feeling that, whether I succeed or not, the outcome of this mission is going to be decisive for one or the other of us. It will not be a drawn game. But now I have a number of further questions with which I must worry you and the superintendent. They are small matters of detail, but I want to get everything right before I start." Tiger looked relieved. The raw animalism in Bond's face had been so different from the stoical, ironical face of the Bondo-san for whom he had come to have so much affection. He gave his great golden smile and said, "But of course, my friend, and I am pleased with your worries and with the trouble you are taking to make sure of everything in advance. You will forgive me if I quote you one last Japanese proverb. It says, 'A reasonable number of fleas is good for a dog. Otherwise, the dog forgets he is a dog.'" "Good old Basho," said Bond. Chapter 13. Kishi Suzuki. James Bond went through the rest of the morning like an automaton. While he tried on his ninja equipment and watched each item being carefully packed into a floatable plastic container, his mind was totally occupied with the image of his enemy, this man, Blofeld, the great gangster who had founded Spectre, the special executive for counterintelligence, terrorism, revenge, and extortion, the man who was wanted by the police of all the NATO countries, the man who had murdered Tracy, Bond's wife, for less than a day, a bare 9 months ago. And in those 9 months, this evil genius had invented a new method of collecting death, as Tiger had put it. This cover is the Swiss Dr. Shatterhand, as a rich botanist, must have been one of the many he had wisely built up over the years. It would have been easy. A few gifts of rare plants to famous botanical gardens, the financing of a handful of expeditions, and all the while, in the back of his mind, the plan one day to retire and cultiver son jardin. And what a garden! A garden that would be like a deadly flytrap for human beings, a killing bottle for those who wanted to die. And, of course, Japan, with the highest suicide statistics in the world, a country with an unquenchable thirst for the bizarre, the cruel, and the terrible, would provide the perfect last refuge for him. Blofeld must have gone off his head, but with a monstrous, calculating madness, the madness of the genius he undoubtedly was. And the whole demoniac concept was on Blofeld's usual grand scale, the scale of a Caligula, of a Nero, of a Hitler, of any other great enemy of mankind. The speed of execution was breathtaking, the expenditure fabulous, the planning, down to the use of the Black Dragon Society, meticulous, and the cover as impeccable as the Peace Gloria Clinic, which, less than a year before, Bond had helped to destroy utterly. And now the two enemies were lined up again, but this time David was spurred on to kill his Goliath, not by duty, but by a blood feud. And with what weapons? Nothing but his bare hands, a 2-inch pocket knife, and a thin chain of steel. Well, similar weapons had served him before. Surprise would be the determining factor. Bond added a pair of black flippers to his equipment, a small supply of pemmican-like meat, benzedrine tablets, a plastic flask of water. Then he was ready. They motored down the main street to where the police launch was waiting at the jetty, and set off at a good 20 knots across the beautiful bay and round the headland into the Sea of Genkai. Tiger produced sandwiches and a flask of sake for each of them, and they ate their luncheon as the jagged green coast with its sandy beaches passed slowly by to port. Tiger pointed out a distant dot on the horizon. "Koro Island," he said. "Cheer up, Bondo-san. You seem preoccupied. Think of all those beautiful naked women you will soon be swimming with, and this Japanese Greta Garbo with whom you will be passing the nights. And the sharks who will already be gathering at the news of my swim to the castle. If they do not eat the amas, why should they eat a bit of tough Englishman? Look at the two fish eagles circling. That is an excellent augury. One alone would have been less propitious. Four would have been disastrous, for with us, four is the same as your 13, the worst number of all. But, Bondo-san, does it not amuse you to think of that foolish dragon dozing all unsuspecting in his castle, while St. George comes silently riding towards his lair across the waves? It would make the subject of a most entertaining Japanese print. You've got a funny sense of humor, Tiger. It is merely different from yours. Most of our funny stories involve death or disaster. I am not a picture daddy, a professional storyteller, but I will tell you my favorite. It concerns the young girl who comes to the toll bridge. She tosses 1 sen, a very small piece of money, to the watchman, and walks on. The watchman calls after her, "Hey, you know that the toll for crossing the bridge is 2 sen. The girl answers, "But I do not intend to cross the bridge. I intend only to go halfway, and then throw myself into the river." Tiger laughed uproariously.
Bond smiled politely. "I must save that one up for London. They'll split their sides over it."
The small speck on the horizon grew larger, and soon revealed itself as a horned island about 5 miles in circumference, with steep cliffs and a small harbour facing north. On the mainland, Dr. Shatterhand's small peninsula reached out into the sea, and the fortress-like black wall soared up out of the breaking waves. Above it were the tops of trees, and behind them, in the distance, the winged roof of the topmost story of the castle broke the skyline. The formidable silhouette reminded Bond vaguely of photographs of Alcatraz taken from sea level. He shivered slightly at the thought of the night's swim across the half-mile channel, and of the black spider that would then scale those soaring fortifications. Ah, well. He turned his attention back to Kura Island. It appeared to be made of black volcanic rock, but there was much green vegetation right up to the summit of a small peak on which there was some kind of a stone beacon. When they rounded the headland that formed one arm of the bay, a crowded little village and a jetty appeared. Out to sea, 30 or more rowing boats were scattered, and there was the occasional glint of pink flesh in the sunlight. Naked children were playing among the big, smooth black boulders that turned like bathing hippos along the shoreline, and there were green nets hung up to dry. It was a pretty scene, with the delicate remoteness, the fairy-tale quality of small fishing communities all the world over. Bond took an immediate liking to the place, as if he was arriving at a destination that had been waiting for him, and that would be friendly and welcoming. A group of village elders, grave, gnarled old men with the serious expressions of simple people on important occasions, led by a Shinto priest, was on the jetty to welcome them. The priest was in ceremonial robes, a dark red three-quarter-length kimono, with vast hanging sleeves, a turquoise skirt in broad pleats, and the traditional shining black hat in the shape of a blunt cone. He was a man of simple dignity and considerable presence, middle-aged, with a round face and round spectacles, and a pursed, judging mouth. His shrewd eye took them in one by one as they came ashore, but they rested longest on Bond. Superintendent Ando was greeted with friendship as well as respect. This was part of his parish, and he was the ultimate source of all fishing permits, reflected Bond ungraciously. But he had to admit that the deference of the bows was not exaggerated, and that he was lucky in his ambassador. They proceeded up the cobbled path of the main street to the priest's house, a modest, weather-beaten affair of stone and carpentered driftwood. They entered, and sat on the spotless, polished wood floor in an arc in front of the priest, and the superintendent made a long speech, punctuated by serious hi's and oh, sodeskas from the priest, who occasionally let his wise eyes rest thoughtfully on Bond. He made a short speech in return, to which the superintendent and Tiger listened with deference. Tiger replied, and the business of the meeting was over, save for the inevitable tea. Bond asked Tiger how his presence and mission had been explained. Tiger said that it would have been of no use lying to the priest, who was a shrewd man, so he had been told most of the truth. The priest had expressed regret that such extreme measures were contemplated, but he agreed that the castle across the sea was a most evil place, and its owner a man in league with the devil. In the circumstances, he would give the project his blessing, and James Bond would be allowed to stay on the island for the minimum time necessary to accomplish his mission. The priest would invite the Suzuki family to accord him an honourable welcome. Bond would be explained away to the elders as a famous Gaijin anthropologist who had come to study the Ama way of life. Bond should therefore study it, but the priest requested that Bond should behave in a sincere manner. "Which means," explained Tiger with a malicious grin, "that you are not to go to bed with the girls." In the evening, they walked back to the jetty. The sea was a dark slate colour and mirror calm. The little boats, bedecked with coloured flags, which meant that it had been an exceptional day's fishing, were winging their way back. The entire population of Kura, perhaps 200 souls, was lined up along the shore to greet the heroines of the day, the older people holding carefully folded shawls and blankets to warm up the girls on their way back to their homes, where, according to Tiger, they would be given hot basin baths to get back their circulation and remove all traces of salt. It was now 5 o'clock. They would be asleep by 8, said Tiger, and out again with the dawn. Tiger was sympathetic. You'll have to adjust your hours, Bondo-san, and your way of life. The Ama live very frugally, very cheaply, for their earnings are small, no more than the price of sparrows' tears, as we say. And for heaven's sake, be very polite to the parents, particularly the father. As for Kisi, he left the sentence hanging in the air. Eager hands reached for each boat, and with happy shouts pulled it up on the black pebbles. Big wooden tubs were lifted out and rushed up the beach to a kind of rickety market, where, according to Tiger, the awabi were graded and priced. Meanwhile, the chattering, smiling girls waded in through the shallows and cast modestly appraising glances at the three mainland strangers on the jetty. To Bond, they all seemed beautiful and gay in the soft evening light, the proud, rather coarse-nippled breasts, the gleaming, muscled buttocks, cleft by the black cord that held in place the frontal triangle of black cotton, the powerful thong round the waist with its string of oval lead weights, through which was stuck an angular steel pick, the white rag round the tumbled hair, and below, the laughing, dark eyes and lips that were happy with the luck of the day. At that moment, it all seemed to Bond as the world, as life, should be, and he felt ashamed of his city slicker appearance, let alone the black designs it concealed. One girl, rather taller than the rest, seemed to pay no attention to the men on the jetty or to the police launch riding beside it. She was the centre of a crowd of laughing girls, as she waded with a rather long, perhaps studied stride over the shiny black pebbles and up the beach. She flung back a remark at her companions, and they giggled, putting their hands up to their mouths. Then a wizened old woman held out a coarse brown blanket to her, and she wrapped it round herself, and the group dispersed. The couple, the old woman and the young one, walked up the beach to the market. The young one talked excitedly. The old one paid attention and nodded. The priest was waiting for them. They bowed very low. He talked to them, and they listened with humility, casting occasional glances towards the group on the jetty. The tall girl drew her blanket more closely round her. James Bond had guessed it already. Now he knew. This was Kisi Suzuki. The three people, the splendidly attired priest, the walnut-faced old fisherwoman, and the tall, naked girl wrapped in her drab blanket, came along the jetty, the girl hanging back. In a curious way, they were a homogeneous trio, and the priest might have been the father. The woman stopped, and the priest came forward. He bowed to Bond and addressed him. Tiger translated. He says that the father and mother of Kisi Suzuki would be honored to receive you in their humble abode, for whose poverty they apologize. They regret that they are not accustomed to Western ways, but their daughter is proficient in English as a result of her work in America, and will endeavor to convey your wishes to them. The priest asks if you can row a boat. The father, who previously rowed for his daughter, is stricken with rheumatism. It would be of great assistance to the family if you would deign to take his place. Bond bowed. He said, Please convey to His Reverence that I am most grateful for his intercession on my behalf. I would be most honored to have a place to lay my head in the home of Suzuki-san. My needs are very modest, and I greatly enjoy the Japanese way of life. I would be most pleased to row the family boat or help the household in any other way, he added, sotto voce. Tiger, I may need these people's help when the time comes, particularly the girls. How much can I tell her? Tiger said softly. Use your discretion. The priest knows, therefore the girl can know. She will not spread it abroad. And now, come forward and let the priest introduce you. Don't forget that your name here is Taro, which means first son. Todoroki, which means thunder. The priest is not interested in your real name. I have said that this is an approximation of your English name. It doesn't matter. Nobody will care. But you must try to assume some semblance of a Japanese personality, for when you get to the other side. This name is on your identity card and on your miners' union card from the coal mines at Fukuoka. You need not bother with these things here, for you are among friends. On the other side, if you are caught, you will show the card that says you are deaf and dumb, all right? Tiger talked to the priest, and Bond was led forward to the two women. He bowed low to the mother, but he remembered not to bow too low, as she was only a woman. And then he turned to the girl. She laughed gaily. She didn't titter or giggle. She actually laughed. She said, "You don't have to bow to me, and I shall never bow to you." She held out her hand. "How do you do? My name is Kissy Suzuki." The hand was ice cold. Bond said, "My name is Taro Todoroki, and I'm sorry to have kept you here so long. You're cold, and you ought to go and have your hot bath. It is very kind of your family to accept me as your guest, but I do not want to be an imposition. Are you sure it's all right?" "Whatever the Kanushi-san, the priest, says is all right, and I have been called before. When you have finished with your distinguished friends, my mother and I will be happy to lead you to our house. I hope you're good at peeling potatoes." Bond was delighted. Thank God for a straightforward girl at last. No more bowing and hissing. He said, "I took a degree in it, and I'm strong and willing, and I don't snore. What time do we take out the boat?"
"About 5:30, when the sun comes up. Perhaps you will bring me good luck. The awabi shells are not easy to find. We had a lucky day today, and I earned about $30, but it is not always so."
"I don't reckon in dollars. Let's say £10.
"Aren't Englishmen the same as Americans? Isn't the money the same?"
"Very alike, but totally different."
"Is that so?"
"You mean all Sobeska?" The girl laughed.
"You have been well trained by the important man from Tokyo.
Perhaps you will now say goodbye to him, and we can go home. It is at the other end of the village."
The priest, the superintendent, and Tiger had been talking together, ostensibly paying no attention to Bond and the girl. The mother had been standing humbly, but with shrewd eyes, watching every expression on the two faces. Bond now bowed again to her, and went back to the group of men. Farewells were brief. Dusk was creeping up over the sea, and the orange ball of the sun had already lost its brilliance in the evening haze. The engine of the police boat had been started up, and its exhaust bubbled softly. Bond thanked the superintendent and was wished good fortune in his honourable endeavours. Tiger looked serious. He took Bond's hand in both of his, an unusual gesture for a Japanese. He said,
"Bondo-san, I am certain you will succeed, so I will not wish you luck. Nor will I say sayonara, farewell. I will simply say a quiet banzai to you, and give you this little present, though, in case the gods frown upon your venture, and, through no fault of yours, things go wrong, very wrong."
He took out a little box and gave it to Bond. The box rattled. Bond opened it. Inside was one long, brownish pill. Bond laughed. He gave it back to Tiger and said, "No thanks, Tiger. As Basho said, or almost said, you only live twice. If my second life comes up, I would rather look it in the face and not turn my back on it. But thanks. And thanks for everything. Those live lobsters were really delicious. I shall now look forward to eating plenty of seaweed while I'm here. So long. See you in about a week." Tiger got down into the boat and the engine revved up. As the boat took the swell at the entrance to the harbour, Tiger raised a hand and brought it swiftly down with a chopping motion, and then the boat was round the seawall and out of sight. Bond turned away. The priest had gone. Kissy Suzuki said impatiently,
"Come along, Todoroki-san. The Kanushi-san says I'm to treat you as a comrade, as an equal. But give me one of those two little bags to carry. For the sake of the villagers who will be watching inquisitively, we will wear the oriental face in public."
And the tall man with the dark face, cropped hair and slanting eyebrows, the tall girl and the old woman walked off along the shore with their angular Japanese shadows preceding them across the smooth black boulders.